prior to the last couple of years, we've been in a clean energy demand constrained world. That is, there isn't enough demand for clean energy. Mm-hmm. Today, we are now in a supply constrained world where there isn't enough clean energy to go around because these companies haven't scaled. So what does that mean? It means that when you're negotiating for the first of a kind, call it small modular nuclear reactor, all of a sudden, Microsoft wants it, Amazon wants it, Google wants it, all the hyperscalers need it because they have AI demands, power demands that are going through the roof. They don't even actually know how fast it's going through the roof. And so they're just like, I need all the power I can. And if you're a small modular nuclear reactor developer, you have power in that negotiation for the first time ever.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, the number one podcast for climate tech entrepreneurs. In this episode, Silas and I chat with Michael Hierney, general partner of Engine Ventures. Engine Ventures invests in tough tech. That's one of my favorite terms now, but it basically means founders who are tackling big problems and really tough problems in climate change. If you think about what makes investing in deep tech so hard, it's a combination of being complex, expensive, and that few people actually know how it works. Well, that's why Engine Ventures exists. They were spun out of MIT to help these crazy smart scientists make businesses out of their inventions. Basically a mix of Albert Einstein and Steve Jobs. And who could stop that? We also didn't make it easy for him. The first question we hit him with was about politics. So we basically broke every dinner table rule right off the bat. Hats off to Mike for being a great sport and pulling through. We talked about how the IRA is leading to market creation, the political durability of climate tech, why they invest in tough tech founders, the three key elements of their thesis, techno-economic modeling, what's happening in energy now that we are supply constrained, and more. As always, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode. A quick reminder to subscribe. This is a huge, huge way in which you can support us and all the work that we do. Everything we do here is totally out of our free time. We all have day jobs, but it is the passion for supporting founders that keeps us going. If you'd like to support our mission, please consider subscribing. Anyway, let's get into the episode. All right, Mike, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Super excited for this. I think what some of the stuff we are working on is really, really top of mind. You had a lot of kick-ass points from when we kicked off our prep call together. So Silas and I have been eagerly waiting this episode. So thanks so much for joining us.
Likewise, it's a pleasure.
Please don't keep the audience in suspense. Who are you?
Yeah, so I'm Michael Carney. I'm one of the partners at the Engine Ventures. I've been here for about 6 years. My background's all on the energy side. I helped launch a grid-scale energy storage company in 2010 called Ampery, and was there, led business development there for about 5 years before going back to MIT, where I led a research project called the Roosevelt Project, which was all about how do we more rapidly accelerate deep decarbonization? What are the techno-economic pathways to doing that? And that led me to meet the team here at the Engine back in shortly after it was started in 2017, and I came on board in 2018 to help support companies that were building and developing transformational technologies, mostly on the climate side.
Amazing. There's a lot to unpack there. The first thing I'd love to jump into is we love to start off with really, really easy questions. So I'm going to give you a real softball here. The IRA is a very, very poignant piece of legislation related to climate. It is perhaps the generational piece of climate legislation in our generation, as well as for years to come. However, the IRA has been looked at as somewhat of a pivotal political piece of legislation as well. However, we know that you believe something different about it. So please tell us, why do you think the IRA is politically durable?
Yeah, so not starting with a soft one for sure. Appreciate that. And I will just say I agree with your characterization, as it is a critical piece of market creation for all of the stuff that we're doing on climate, and it is really important. It has created, you know, hundreds of trillion dollar opportunities in markets that didn't previously exist: carbon capture, hydrogen, et cetera. Very important. Why do I think it's politically durable? And I think it is important to probably break up the IRA into the many different facets that are comprised within it. And just caveat, like, I do think in a world where Republicans control both the House, the Senate, and the presidency, there will be pieces of the IRA that are rolled back. But not all of it. And I think, so let's just talk, maybe we can break it into a couple examples. The reality is that over the last couple years, a lot of money has flown into carbon capture, into hydrogen, into battery manufacturing, much of which, not all of which, but much of which is happening in red states and is a very positive impact on those communities. And I think that will be politically durable. I think there is another set, and I think Republicans have been pretty clear on this, where perhaps the tax credits for wind and solar will get pared back a little bit. The consumer electric vehicle tax credit could get pared back a bit. Those are more at risk. But the broad characterization of the IRA is it is a set of incentives to pull money in from the private sector. So it is a private sector led energy transition. And we're already seeing that. There are almost $300 billion spent in 2023 on the energy transition. That's MIT numbers from the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy Research and the Rhodium Group, I think is really compelling. Those numbers are projected to just increase with the IRA going out to 2030 toward $1 trillion a year. And so it is going to be a private sector led transition. The IRA puts in mechanisms to enable that and to pull in capital. I think that is what is politically durable.
You said two really, really key things there. One is calling it a critical piece of market creation. I think that's an important part that's really coming to realization now, as we've seen some maturity of climate technologies over the past year or two. Some major parts of the IRA have finally passed, and those loans and grants are starting to come into play. So you can see increased optimism on the side of private companies and startups about building clean energy technology, and especially financing clean energy technology. You also mentioned that projects in red states are happening, and that is an incentive to keep something like this going. And I feel like that's an incredibly unique perspective, not necessarily that we haven't heard before, but it's really encouraging to see how much of a difference there's been in the tone in the past couple of weeks, especially related to the projects that the IRA is financing. Your background in climate tech is incredibly relevant here because you get to see a lot of cutting-edge innovation with your work at The Engine. I'd love to start by just breaking down, what do you do there and how does the ecosystem break apart? Because it's a fairly complex but really interesting ecosystem.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So maybe just a high level on the origins of The Engine as a whole, and then getting into what we do and why it's a little different than what has previously existed. So back in 2015 or so, Rafael Rafe, the president of MIT, was, and he wrote articles on it, was frustrated with the degree to which technologies and inventions, breakthrough applied research, was not translating from the academic realm into the commercial realm. Great ideas were getting published and patented, but they were not turning into commercial startups and or leading to global impact. And impact is, you know, one of MIT's mission is around impact. And so he asked a group of faculty, like, what could MIT do to change that game? And The Engine as an institution was the manifestation of that work. And so it was formed in 2017. And there's really, I think there's three legs to the stool that is The Engine. The first is you have to have capital allocators who are willing to take a longer term view on economic transition and invest into foundational pillars, but that based in real science that will change the world, impact the world in a positive way, but might take a little bit longer to do that. Because traditional venture capital markets were highly optimized, venture capital firms were highly optimized for experimentation cycles around software and not around hardware, which can take a little bit longer. So Engine Ventures is that leg of the stool. Second is those startups need access to space and equipment and programming that can help them be successful. In going back to my time at Ambria, I think we spent probably a year of time and a lot of money building out a new facility in Cambridge just to hop off of campus and replicate our results developing battery cells. Right, replicate the results in a year. And part of that was because there was just no space for us to go. And the equipment we had to get in place to actually do that. So today I'm working out of the engine building here on Main Street in Cambridge. It's 200,000 square feet of space, but most of it is lab space, biolab, chem lab, machine shop, imaging equipment, high bay space, fabrication space. A lot of the, I would say it's like 90-95% of the things that startups in tough tech need to get to just to get going, right? To decrease that experimentation time associated with some of these companies. So that's on the infrastructure side. And then the third leg of the stool is the community around which and the stakeholders around which these companies need to be in order to be successful. So I think in these spaces, climate is no different. It's highly critical that you're in conversations with corporates who could be potential partners or customers, with policymakers and regulators, because everything we do in climate has a policy or regulation bend to it, no matter how much we try to abstract away from that or kid ourselves that it's not there. And then talent, who are the engineers that you need to hire, and the executive experience that you need to surround yourself with in order to build these types of companies. So those three legs of the stools, they are actually manifested in two different organizations that are tied together, the Engine Accelerator and then the Engine Ventures. And so I sit on the venture side, but we have a very close relationship with the team on the accelerator side, and we work together on lots of different things.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show.
So to make sure I understand, the three things that you're built upon are, one, the long-term view of investing in science. I love the term that you use, tough tech. Did you make that up, or where did that come from?
That was from the early days of it was with the engine was the formulation of tough tech.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. So there's a long-term view investing in science. There is the pure demand and need for space and creating that. And then there's the desire to have the community and talent surrounding that. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, those are the three legs of the stool that you need in order to change the game from a venture community that is highly optimized for rapid experimentation cycles and fast failure, often associated with software, sometimes associated with life science. But to change the game so that ecosystem could be put to work to translate some of these different types of innovations into commercial impact.
And what that's manifesting to is your two operating models, which is the accelerator and the venture firm.
That's right.
Very cool. One thing I'd love to just get at philosophically and get your opinion on is, when you look at the setup of this problem, which is you need to invest a little more long term, you have a little higher CapEx, it's a little harder to find this talent. What made you feel strongly about the venture and accelerator model? Why do you see this as the theory of change for you?
Yeah. So I think one, having lived it, I told you the story about our space pursuits and the futility of them back at Ambry. But I think more than that, there's a set of frictions that are embedded in how we translate technology from the from a research setting into the commercial setting. And the engine model, right, our goal is to remove those frictions. We do that with capital, we do that with space, and we do that with people. Talent is a really big piece of this. That is not the whole game, right? I mean, I think that is a big swing, And I think over the last 7 years, we've seen that if you put those pieces together, we can build meaningful, impactful companies, which at the end of the day is the goal. There are other problems that exist in that moment of translation or lack thereof that that are worth highlighting and I think should give everyone concern because of the economic potential that is left hanging on the vine when social dynamics don't lead to something translating, whether it's a gender issue in academia or training of how we train potential innovators and entrepreneurs in those settings, the biases around tenure and the pursuit of tenure in academia. These are all things that exist and are hard, but not what a single institution can change. I think MIT's took a really big swing with the formation of the engine and should be applauded for that. And we're seeing that big companies can come out the back end of the system. And that's what's really exciting. But it's not everything.
One thing that really fascinates me is usually the transition from, like, let's call it small company energy to, like, okay, now we've figured out the problem and we're going and we got to scale. Usually there's a huge, I mean, you talked about talent, obviously that's what I'm passionate about, that's what I do. But I'm curious if you are able to put your finger on either the challenges or the key ingredients required to go from, okay, we've got this idea, we've kind of figured it out in the lab, to now we're putting steel in the ground or, you know, whatever the example is, but actually moving things to scale. Because when I look at the landscape of climate tech over the past few years, there are a shitload of companies dying at the early stage, and they're not getting to this point where they're raising a large Series B and actually making things happen. So I'm kind of curious your take, because I'm pretty sure the engine has seen quite a number of companies get to that point.
Yeah, that's a great question, Silas. You know, in the early days of the engine, I think, and I get asked the question, you know, in many ways, the engine was set up by MIT as an experiment, right? Could you put these elements together and build an innovation ecosystem around tough tech? And, you know, that's an experiment that's a decade-long experiment, right? And it's going to take multiple, probably 2 decades for us to understand whether, you know, the real fruits of it. But there are near-term things that I can point to that are going to begin to address your question. I think that in the last 6 years, the model, what I've experienced, and actually I think we are in this kind of running a playbook that was run by the life sciences industry here in Massachusetts back 20 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, where you're beginning to see in this climate world, you're beginning to see labor transition from large companies to startups. And that is a real metric of success, both of the health of the community and the opportunities that those companies are going after. It's also really critical to bridging the gap that you just highlighted, right? So the ability to go from a benchtop product to having the credibility to go out to investors and say, I'm going to go build a 100x version of this in a field at a customer site. That is a absolutely different job. And it requires you that you are comfortable, A, surrounding yourself with people who have done that before. Because if you go to an investor and you're like, hey, yeah, I need $100 million to go build a factory, and you don't have anybody on your team who's built a factory, you're not getting that money. It's not going to happen. And probably more than one person is probably necessary in that way. So the fluidity of those labor markets is really important. What we see in life science today is you see executives leaving major big pharma companies to be the CEOs of, like, seed stage startups, right? That is a fluid labor market. We're not there yet on the energy side, but ultimately I think that's where we need to go. And we'll get there because we'll start seeing returns to those companies, and that's going to draw more talent. And then B, I think what's happened in life science is that you have the risk of joining a startup in Cambridge is so low, because if it doesn't work, you'll jump to the next one right away. That is becoming true on the energy and climate side, which I think is really, really important. both for the health of the community, but for those startups that need those people to then scale. So it's a reinforcing feedback loop that I think, Silas, to your point, more companies will be able to bridge that gap on a go-forward basis because of the talent that's coming in.
Is there usually a specific point when this happens? Like, okay, we've done a pilot and now we're going to bring in these people. Like, are they usually getting people lined up prior to raising that huge round where they really go and scale? Like, what do you typically see there?
So I think that the most common failure mode is not early enough. Right. Okay. With the teams that I work with, I encourage bringing on those people very early because, you know, that's just it's a bit of the nature of innovation where you can innovate, you can improve technical performance at low volume, at small scale, but you often need actual innovation to be able to execute it at high volume, at high scale. And those process engineers, primarily process engineers, are not the same who understand how to do that are not the same who know how to improve technical performance at the bench top. And so you've got to begin to layer those people in pretty quickly. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for a massive pivot technically once you've demonstrated a performance requirement that, in fact, when you try to get it to scale, it doesn't scale.
Yeah. I find it quite fascinating working with early stage startups that, I mean, every founder has their own opinions about things, right? No matter how junior they are and how many times they've not been around the block, they have opinions. And oftentimes, something that comes up pretty frequently is they don't like the idea of somebody coming from being a big company. They assume that that person does not know how to wear multiple hats, et cetera. Have you, I guess, run into any of these kind of dilemmas with the founders? Like, especially, I'm assuming a good number of your founders are kind of graduates from MIT going in and then building these companies, right? Maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but have you seen any ways that you kind of help them over this hurdle to recognize, hey, you might be really, really smart at this science thing, but you need to be willing to bring in these other people who have done other things and find ways to interact with them coming from a big company while being in a small company and learning how to work together?
Yeah. So there's a lot there. And so I'll try to tick through some of it. Like the first is on the latter point, which is how do we assess that in founders early on? The answer is absolutely yes. Like founders that understand the challenge ahead of them is critical, and understanding the talent that you need to surround yourself with in time to do that is critical. So we work with our teams on that all the time. Trying to figure out what are the gaps and how do we get those filled quickly so that we can continue to grow the company is a core piece of work, particularly, Silas, to your point, when you are investing early and often in technology-based founders, which we do quite a bit of at Engine Ventures. There's another piece, though, which is about the fit culturally with somebody coming from a big company to a small company. And here I actually don't characterize the fear the same way you do. I think that it is actually quite rational, and it's rational because there are many mismatches of that fit that I've seen. So it is really hard to balance, going out recruiting someone from an organization that might be, 30,000 people to join a 30-person team and have that person be comfortable with the dynamism, the speed, the urgency around which a startup has to work. So you have to be very conscious of that. Simultaneously, you've got to want to make it work, right? And you've got to do the work to help that be a fit. I don't ever see it as the latter being the failure mode. Like like a founder doesn't want to do the work to make it work. That's uncommon in my experience. The challenge of making it work is real. It's just got to be part of the hiring process to make sure you're targeting people who would be comfortable with it. I think the broader point, though, is the reason why that friction exists is the startup needs to be able to balance the need to go quickly with the process, increasing amount of process required to do things diligently in time. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that balance has to be, it has to be right. It has to be right in your technical approach, your data acquisition, your technical reviews. It has to be right in who you're hiring as well. And so that's the balance. It's between the benefit of a startup is being able to go fast and be agile and dynamic. But also as you're scaling, you've got to be able to deliver very high tolerances and on time and on budget. So you have to be able to evolve in time, and that is really hard to do. But it's something all of these companies need.
Yeah. Finding the right people, who can join early, but also have the tolerance to change, like the detail orientedness as they go, is important. And I also think, usually the biggest success is when you can find, it's obviously not easy, but when you can find somebody who has been at a very small company and gone through the large growth phase. So they've actually been, you know, in the exact phase, right? It's yeah. difficult to find, but
that's what
you can do it. So I appreciate the point.
But I think more than anything, and the match is really important. But I think more than anything, just to reiterate, like, I have a ton of hope about this community being able to deliver on its promises, because we are beginning to be able to recruit those people and keep them. And I think that is really exciting.
And like you said, we're at the beginning of the transition that the life sciences industry did. So we have somewhat of a playbook that we can reference. And speaking of an analogy, you talked about startups not moving fast enough. It reminded me of a quote that Paul Graham said, that he always bragged about how small his companies were. And I think in a very similar capacity, it's almost the same level of thinking about trying to make sure that you're getting the right people so that you're not adding more bureaucracy and burden to a process that needs to be fast. And that being the priority.
Yes, largely agree. But simultaneously, we have to recognize that, like, when you're building something in the field, like, you're not a small company.
Yeah,
you've got to get the people you need to do that.
I think the biggest thing I've noticed is that the difference with most, you call it tough tech, right? Like, most of this is that your customers, their tolerance for shit breaking is zero.
Zero.
It has to work. Yeah. So this is the word innovation is not their favorite.
Yeah, this is why, you know, the we run a program called Blueprint, which is all about, it's a for proto entrepreneurs, so folks who haven't yet started a company but are thinking about it, mostly PhD students, postdocs, whatever. And I, you know, Silas, your comment made me think of the idea of a minimum viable product in these spaces, right? Like, that is the nature of entrepreneurship training in most settings. Go figure out what your minimum viable product is and go build it. That doesn't exist in climate or in tough tech. You cannot, there's no minimum anything. You have to deliver a product that works in the specs that you've promised, and you have to do that well. If you don't, you're not going to be able to raise capital on the back end, and you're not going to get the customer to buy more on the back end. And so there's a degree, just to echo your point, the tolerance has to be exactly right.
So we've started off with a very, very easy topic, politics. Now we've broken down the engine, and we've even gotten into some of the techniques that and things that really matter about labor and the transition of this industry. One thing I'd love to dive into is going back to Engine Ventures and talking a little bit about your model, how you operate, and what's your idea of success. So please, for the audience, tell us, how does Engine Ventures work? What's your investment model, and what do you focus on?
Yeah, so at Engine Ventures, we invest across three broad categories. Climate change mitigation, one. Human health improvement, two. And advanced systems and infrastructure, three. And advanced systems and infrastructure, that's where we have computing, AI, mobility, the built environment kind of sits in there. All three of these things are interrelated in practice, have companies that are being built pretty similar. So there's a lot of, I think, things that we have to learn on the climate side from peers in life science and peers in advanced systems and mobility, et cetera. And we typically will, from a check size perspective, we typically lead pre-seeds, seeds, and series A's. And we do that depending on, you know, the specific opportunity. We're comfortable in all three of those. And then we work with those teams and try to build them into large companies on a go-forward basis. But that's kind of our investment remit. From the beginning, it has been that. We invest primarily in companies that have spun out of kind of deep research and breakthrough technology. For me, I think that that's across our domains. And then we've invested in companies out of MIT, as you noted, but also out of Harvard, out of Rice University in Texas, out of Northwestern, out of in companies in the Bay Area as well. So we're not geographically focused exclusively here in Massachusetts.
So it's really the commercialization aspect of it is a real strong suit, looking at that and playing that playbook.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Could you talk to us a little bit about that? I mean, I think being able to be at so many different data points of people who work in science and academia and deep research and trying to commercialize that technology, it's a very difficult thing. A lot of it's mindset shift, a lot of it's technical challenges and how you, like you said, convince investors to back your projects. What have you seen and what works for people who are trying to commercialize technology?
Yeah, well, let me just focus in on the climate here, the climate side of this, which I think, you know, it was interesting when we started Ambry back in 2010, there was, you know, maybe one or two grid scale energy storage projects in the United States. They were both funded by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and they were both using lithium ion batteries, and they were both using them for frequency regulation on the grid, which is a small market as a whole. And so when we were doing that, you know, we had to both convince ourselves, but convince investors and then also explain to the market where we were creating value and why energy storage should be valued in electricity systems writ large, whether you were selling to utilities or participating in wholesale energy and energy markets, doing arbitrage, whatever, with independent power production models, you had to make the case. Like, we had to do that from scratch. And so we did. And we did a whole bunch of analytics and modeling around that to make that case. And I think that was productive. Fast forward 10 years, if I'm a startup in the energy storage space, I don't have to convince a soul that there's a large market out there. It's like, you know, not only has there been billions of dollars of deployment, there's projections that those billions of dollars are turning into $1 trillion in the next decade and a half. So there's like, it's a different game today than it was a decade and a half ago, which is really good. And I think that's actually true across the board as it relates to climate. We have now seen success in energy storage. We've seen success in solar and wind. We've seen success in electrification, vehicle electrification. We're beginning to see it in other sectors, in heat pumps and those sorts of things. So making the commercial case has changed. And this goes back to our IRA point, where there's now real markets that you're innovating into. But I think there are still a few mechanisms that teams are using productively to engage those markets. You know, the first, as I said, was my experience. The first is analytics and simulation. One, those tools have done nothing but get much, much better over the last 10 years across fields. And so being able to explain to your customer the value proposition without having to put any steel in the ground is really, really valuable. It gets customers to make decisions early and to put money into projects. It gets EPCs comfortable supporting the build of projects. And because it is very clear what needs to be built. And so that has accelerated, I would say, deployment and tough tech. It has accelerated everything from kind of the molecular level and advanced material synthesis all the way through pilot deployment and customer engagement. So I think that is one thing that's really exciting. The other, you know, critical piece, and we work on this with teams very early, often before investments, is around techno-economic modeling. And having a rigorous assessment of your potential cost position at scale. Because at the end of the day, in climate, the only thing that matters is whether or not you can deploy at scale at cost. And if you can't, like, and the challenge in climate is it's, that could be a 6 to 10 year trajectory to get there, to validate it. But you need to have proof points along the way to demonstrate. So the way I think about that is, one, you do the TEA up front. Does that show that you can create a massive delta in the market? So contingent on that being, yes, I can get comfortable with the early stages. However, the question is, if you can't compete until you are building a gigawatt scale plant, say, either on the manufacturing side or on power production or whatever, if that is the scale you got to be at to compete to get your cost down, fine, I think I can be okay with that. That's going to be a $1 billion experiment, but we can get there. If there are proof points along the way where you can validate that you're coming down the cost curve that you predicted in your techno-economic model. So at, call it 500 megawatts, we are going to be at 70% reduction toward the 100% reduction that we need at the gigawatt scale, right? If you can predict that and you're like, yeah, our cost model makes sense, we can validate that with this size deployment and show what that degradation curve on cost looks like, that begins to de-risk a lot of different things, both from the capital side, other investors coming in, but not just from equity players, also from project finance and others that'll get comfortable with the next step that you need to actually compete at scale.
I mean, what you're really painting a picture for is the difference between cleantech 1.0 and where we exist today and cleantech 2.0, or, you know, even further. Seeing what was required all the way back then, and now people understand that there's a big market. You have much more mature analytics and visualization tools and technologies to show that there's potential behind these projects, as well as quicker ways to make the decision and easier ways of modeling the cost and what will hopefully be, you know, your potential for break even and revenue. One thing you talked about on a prep call that really got us excited is you felt as though, I think for this exact reason, that comparing cleantech 1.0 and cleantech 2.0 wasn't really valid. And even though people do it, it's not the best comparison. Is this why? Is there more to this? And one thing I wanted to also find out is there a better comparison that you use, you know, in, if you're ever communicating, you know, what is cleantech 2.0 and what can we look to for inspiration?
Yeah. So this, thanks for the question. I think you characterized my position accurately. There's almost like, it is very hard. It is a very hard comparison to make because of the number of things that are different. And I'll touch on a few. You mentioned them. So the first is around the markets, right? The reality today is between the IRA in the US and sister programs in the EU and elsewhere, then electrification demand, which is going up from electrification of industry, transportation, et cetera. And the topic of the last, you know, few weeks is all around everybody waking up to the demand around the electric demand of AI and AI development, and the reality that the only thing holding back AI development right now is access to power. And then on top of all that is the corporate commitments to decarbonize, which we can argue around like the durability of those. I think to the extent they are not durable, it'll only be at the margin. So I think there's a real good case to make that most of that will hold. And the question is just how, like when and how binding and when, like, but it'll hold in the macro picture. All of that paints a picture today of, we have moved from a, probably for the first time in 100 years, we've moved from a demand constrained world where nobody wanted clean energy or clean anything, wasn't a thing, to now we are massively supply constrained. And that constraint changes the nature of competition in the industry. It changes the nature of competition because all of a sudden, your providers, these startups that have the clean energy solutions of the future, have market power that they didn't previously have. And that means they can win. So that dynamic fundamentally is what is different today than 15 years ago. The nature of competition has changed. And that, I think, is a durable reality that is built on the back of those real market creation mechanisms.
In your opinion, you know, based on the companies that you see, both in your venture firm, but in general, are founders waking up to this? Are they making good use of this? And if not, what do you see them lacking in doing?
It's not just founders that are they are, and I think they're pretty aware. And so, and it comes out in negotiation around pilot agreements and financings. And I think that's where you see it. But it's worth noting, like, the broader community is also seeing it. I mean, in 2023, our numbers were non-traditional investors made up greater than 60% of climate tech deals on a volume basis. So non-traditional is, you think, corporates, hedge funds, others. Corporates are playing a major role in the capital stack today, and they see this. I think they have to recognize that the demand constraints of these companies means if they do not engage with these companies early, they won't be able to engage with these companies by the time they've made that their commitments are binding. And that's a real problem. So they've got to get in early. They got to work with these teams. And I think that has been largely productive. I'm excited to see more of that on a go forward basis.
This is interesting. I'm not sure if I fully understand. Like, I don't want to just gloss over it. Could you kind of help me understand the difference again when you say the nature of competition has changed? I don't quite fully understand what you're suggesting there.
Yeah. So prior to the last couple of years, we've been in a clean energy demand constrained world. That is, there isn't enough demand for clean energy, mm-hmm. right? We began in the 2010s to see great growing demand for electric vehicles and for solar and wind, driven primarily by public policy pulling that stuff into the market because the economics, yeah. right? Today, we are now in a supply constrained world where there isn't enough clean energy to go around yeah. because these companies haven't scaled. Right. So for the next and I think the question in my mind is how long does this era last? How long does it take for these companies to scale to meet that the new demand, right? The new demand that we're seeing. How long does this supply constrained world last? And where are we on the back end of that? So what does that mean? It means that when you're negotiating for the first of a kind, called small modular nuclear reactor, right? All of a sudden, Microsoft wants it, Amazon wants it, Google wants it. All the hyperscalers need it because they have AI demands, power demands that are going through the roof. They don't even actually know how fast it's going through the roof. And so they're just like, I need all the power I can. And if you're a small modular nuclear reactor developer, you have power in that negotiation for the first time.
Okay.
For the first time ever. And that's happening across clean energy. And so that is what I'm talking about. The dynamic of competition and market and who has the power in those negotiations, it's just totally different today.
Do you think that applies to things outside of just clean energy? Because I can understand it in clean energy, but what about other things like green chemicals or these other like newer technologies coming along?
Yeah. So that's where I think the corporate commitments are really important. And I think they will hold. This is true in carbon capture, et cetera, right? Not just chemicals, it's carbon capture, hydrogen, all that. Major driver is around those corporate commitments and the demand for that. Similarly, I mean, I think a couple of years ago, there was analysis around domestically produced electrolyzers. Mm-hmm. And coming out of the IRA with 45V, up in the air a little bit, but it looks like we're converging into a place that's going to make a lot of sense. And the demand for hydrogen is going to tick up from that. There's very little domestic production of electrolyzers, very little. Mm-hmm. And so if you're out buying and you're looking to develop a hydrogen project, you got to find an electrolyzer. Can't go to China because the domestic procurement policies of the U.S. are relevant for the getting access to the tax credit. So we've got to build up that capacity here. We don't have enough electrolyzers. We're going to need to increase capacity quite a bit. That gives those providers negotiating leverage, right? So yeah, okay. I do think it is happening. It's particularly acute right now in electric power, but it is happening across the board. I think
broadly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, to summarize, so basically, broadly speaking, these two things are coming together to make it a very good time to build something in that space, because there's opportunity to get first-of-kind projects out, which is usually extremely difficult, and there's people willing to pay for it, right? There's a lot of reasons, at least as long as it seems like in energy, broadly speaking, will work continually, but is even on the other side, right, other technologies, as long as corporate commitments are still the same, anything that's about around efficiency or kind of improving sustainability, regardless of what it is, will have that hitting power.
Yes, I think that's probably.
One thing I'm always fascinated by with people who sit in your shoes are, what are the areas that you see huge gaps for innovation, like big, huge opportunities for people to come in and solve something that people have a demand for, but there's just nothing there?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this a little bit. I mean, there are very clear ones where it's like, okay, if we're going to build an electrified grid, right? And sorry, if we're going to build an electrified industry, transportation, broader industry, how much do we need to expand the grid? How do we do that? I think, you know, the shortage of grid equipment right now is acute. I think whether it's transformers or inverters, anything, you're looking to buy those products out into the 2030s, feels like that's ripe for innovation, whether it's manufacturing or new entrants, at least. I think that's there. All of the materials and minerals that we're going to need for the energy transition, I think that is an area of interest, I think, on a go-forward basis. And where is the copper coming from, the nickel, the cobalt, but then also the rare earths? How do we develop a circular economy around those things, which we do not have today? It's like 1% of that stuff is recycled. How do you do that? Is that possible? I think those are really interesting. I think that beyond that, I also am looking at a set of things where there might not be demand today, but I think on the back end of this supply constraint, if we scale all of this clean power generation, whether it's geothermal or nuclear fission or fusion or space-based solar, whatever it might be, on the back end of that, we're going to have really, hopefully, really low marginal cost production of power. And how does that change the economy writ large? I think it's going to have significant geographic implications for where we manufacture and what we build. It might change, it might make certain things like direct air capture and other energy intense processes more economically viable. I'm interested in that. So a world of energy abundance, which we haven't had ever, what does that do? I think about desalination, water access, like that's an economic problem about energy. And can we, does low cost energy or energy abundance change that? I think that's another thing.
I think the fallout of increasing demand for energy, but also the potential of meeting that supply, enables so many things. And just thinking about what the future can look like you said, is a very tantalizing, very fun project, but getting there is really, really based on how much we can fill these gaps. We've almost at the end of the episode. It's kind of crazy how quickly the time went. Before we sign off, one of our favorite questions to ask is to understand how we can help founders. In your opinion, whenever you're interacting with founders, what are three things that they do that impress you? You know, things that you remember very, very specifically that like, wow, like that founder really impressed me because they did X, Y, Z. What are some things that come to mind?
Yeah. So let me just start at the top with that, because I feel very lucky in my job. Is I get to interface with a lot of those people on a daily basis. And that's the most inspiring, hopeful thing a person could do, is start a company in the climate space. It is immensely moving. And so I think the ambition is the thing that is most, it's awesome to be able to do that. I feel very lucky. Founders, to answer your question directly around what are the sets of things that they do, I mean, in one is, we talked about team earlier, but willingness to accept you know, where they're at and what they need. Being honest about what is needed to build a really big company, I think that is number one, because that gives me confidence that you can go out and build it. If you know what you need to do and you're right about it, that's awesome. Like, you just go, well, like, I want to support you to do that. Whereas if you have blind spots and you're like, I think I can do this and I don't need this, like, that becomes very difficult. It's also hard to recruit that way. The second, I think, related is surrounding yourselves. Who do you listen to? Who are the people that you talk to when you need advice? And choosing those people wisely and surrounding yourself with those people, recruiting them in, is really, I think, really important. And then the third is, there are so many resources available to climate entrepreneurs today because it's such a big deal. And, you know, we have the Blueprint program. There are others that are awesome. I think what I've noticed is the people that just go out and do all of it, they have oriented themselves to learning everything they like, to learning as a whole. And they're on the ground. They're talking to everybody. They're learning. They're trying to just be, you know, get all the information they can. And then they're just also showing an entrepreneurial spirit. And I think that is, something that sets companies apart.
Amazing. I think with that, we'll wrap up the episode. Mike, thank you so much for coming on. Before we sign off, where can the audience find you?
Yeah, thanks. Thank you guys for having me. I'm Michael at engineventures.com. Shoot me notes. And happy to chat, with anybody. And really appreciate the time today, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Awesome. Everybody. What a killer episode. Welcome to the takeaway section. Let's get straight into it. So there's two things that I found really, really interesting about this conversation. And the one that just kind of blew my mind and is certainly going to change the way I look at life, I mean, in general and the economy, was when he said that low cost energy, the availability of energy at a low cost, will drastically change the geographic, like an economic viability of many things, such as manufacturing, right? You think about manufacturing nowadays, a lot of this is all built around places where there's low cost of energy. Same thing with like Bitcoin mining, right? It's all about where can you get super cheap energy, usually with hydro or some kind of place where it's just persistent low cost energy. If this changes, you know, and it's not something that necessarily areas like counties or states are not constrained by their existing resources necessarily. They can develop new renewables in a way that's going to make them competitive with other areas that traditionally had kind of a natural, let's call it a natural moat in some ways. So that could reshape the entire world geographically and economically if people kind of get in front of this and start planning for this future. That just blew my mind, and I'm certainly going to look at the world differently as I drive around in the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. The second point for me is that we, you know, I've asked a lot of guests in the past about their MVP and how they get started. And we've also talked a lot about how buyers, especially utilities or big companies that are running really big operations, they have zero interest in this idea of innovation or, you know, experimental things. Because if they run an experiment and it breaks, you know, the lights turn off and it costs them millions of dollars, they are just not interested in that. So when he said there is no such thing as an MVP in tough tech, I really agree with him. Like, it's something that I feel like nobody said out loud, but the reality is, you know, if you don't deliver a product that works from the very first day, like if you don't deliver something that is reliable, you're not going to have repeat buyers. So maybe, you know, maybe a takeaway is you don't want to approach him in your first email saying, hey, we've got this MVP we want to show you. So those are my two big things.
I was actually going to give a rebuttal to that because I didn't fully buy into that point. In my opinion, especially with my experience iterating with hardware, you do have somewhat of an MVP that's proving out a concept and you have some obvious difficulties and you scale that up. But as I think to some of the difficulties that arose from that, which is you sometimes burn a lot of capital, you're not scaling fast enough, you have issues that you couldn't have anticipated, maybe it isn't really possible to take an unproven technology to market like that. I don't know. Yeah. It's actually a really interesting point.
I think specifically with some of the hardware, like depending on who your buyer is and depending on what exactly the tech is, if it's hardware related, I think you need to have a certain level of like accuracy on the outcome. It doesn't have to be for everything. You think of like a company like Clip, the bike, you know, clip on bike thing. Like that doesn't have to be a perfect product for it to still work, but it has to work is the point. If it doesn't work at all, people are going to throw it in the trash and be pissed.
Yeah, we hope the Clip founder doesn't hear this clip on bike thing. We know we 100% respect
Clip. Clip makes a great product, by the way. Yeah. They actually do. So they do. Yeah. It's not. It's just an example.
My takeaways for this: I love studying history. Both Silas and I are huge history fans. He talked about having a playbook from life sciences and how people convince top talent within those big industries to step out and do startups. And he said the main reason was the economic viability of doing so. The thing he said was a result of that was a fluid labor market. And I think it'll be really interesting, be an interesting thought exercise for people to look at the people who succeeded in convincing top talent. What happened and what was the outcome of it? And what are the things that we can take as best practices for the climate tech industry? The second thing is, we asked this directly as a question, but he talked about not comparing Cleantech 1.0 and Cleantech 2.0. And frankly, I'm convinced. It's funny because I think we talked about that question directly to another guest and it was, you gave a great answer. But in this case, it became pretty clear that the maturity of analytics, the maturity of the markets, and the fact that demand exists means that the onus on the founder is now about how do you look at the new animation that popped up. For audio listeners, the new Mac animation just popped up in the middle of this. Going back into it, the onus on the founder is not to convince that a market exists, but to prove as to how you're going to make $1 billion. And when your time is limited, it's really interesting to think about how founders should be focusing on that and the execution more than anything. I also want to end it with one funny thing that he mentioned, which is if you think about AI and how AI is helping founders, you know, we've had a lot of AI inventing production and technology and suggestions. AI is also driving up the demand for energy. So in a way, AI is also helping founders by creating the need for founders and energy to solve. I don't know. Pretty neat. But anyway, yeah, thank you all so much for listening.
It is an interesting kind of combination that's happening there. But this was, I think, a banger episode. And I'm going to call it now. We definitely got to have him on again if he'll come back. I hope he enjoyed it because he's got some more topics under the hood we'd love to uncover at some point.
Thanks so much for listening.